Ketan Joshi works in the renewable energy industry. He also has a very inventive imagination. This is what happened as he tried to go to sleep as a boy.
My formative teenage years were spent in a house that sits opposite the CSIRO's Astronomy and Space Science Facility in Sydney. On sleepless summer nights, I'd lie there with the window open and listen carefully to the noises in the neighbourhood. Sometimes I'd hear a weird mechanical noise emanating from the CSIRO amongst the quietly chirping cicadas. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was something amazing. Influenced by my love of science fiction, I'd lie there thinking that if I leant up and glanced out the window, I'd see silver spacecraft hovering above the telescopes. Perhaps they're drawn to Earth by our galactic transmissions. The source of those strange, mechanical noises was a gap in my knowledge, and I filled it with what I did know about sci-fi. I could have got out of bed and investigated the noise, but I felt that the reality was likely to be less exciting than the images I created using my imagination. In these teenage instances, I was drawn in by a logical fallacy. The formation of a story informed by my own worldview and experiences. My own thoughts weren't abnormal or particularly credulous. This style of thinking is extremely common amongst human beings, and it's deeply relevant to our collective response to the very real threat of human-caused climate change. There's a large body of scientific research dedicated to exploring and quantifying the degree to which humans have impacted the churning atmospheric systems that sustain our existence. Globally, 2014 was the hottest year in recorded history. The most recent IPCC report on climate change says, quote, "Human influence on the climate system is clear, and recent anthropogenic emissions of greenhouse gases are the highest in history," unquote. The global expert consensus on climate change is one of the most comprehensively and relentlessly reviewed and re-reviewed in the history of scientific inquiry. The jarringly widespread rejection of climate science can be seen in the most recent polling conducted by the CSIRO, which found that more than 50% of the public reject any human role in fluctuations in the climate system. Contrast this against the level of scientific acceptance of climate change, around 97%. The void between the public rejection of science and the expert acceptance of science is something science communicator John Cook terms the consensus gap. It seems a fair few Australians are unaware of the sheer strength of the science underpinning climate change. Post hoc rationalisations, in the form of compelling narratives, explain why our professional scientists hold views that differ from our own. Researchers hungrily seeking grant money, a global United Nations agenda to depopulate and deindustrialise the world under a single government, or green ideologues taking us back to the Stone Age. These odd, common rationalisations emerge just as frequently in the world of energy, currently undergoing a shift in response to the threat of climate change. One of the policies created to contribute to the process of decarbonisation is Australia's Renewable Energy Target, or RET. The RET is a simple piece of legislation originally created by the Howard government in 2001, designed to encourage investment in the growth of new clean energy sources like wind, solar, and geothermal. Though the RET legislation has had bipartisan support for nearly a decade, Prime Minister Tony Abbott expressed his concerns about the scheme in 2013 when he said, quote, "We are going to review the renewable energy targets. There was going to be a review anyway next year. We take this review very seriously, and one of the things we'll be looking at is the impact of renewable energy on power prices, because renewable energy targets are significantly driving up power prices right now." Prime Minister Abbott's claims came as somewhat of a surprise to those of us in the electricity industry, because the components that make up an average electricity bill have been well examined. The RET makes up about 3% of your average consumer bill. Other components include network investment charges, which are 52%, or retail costs, which are around 14%. But the renewable energy target changes power prices in more ways than just your retail electricity bill. The integration of clean technology into the grid makes electricity bills slightly higher, because retailers pass on the costs of buying the aforementioned certificates to consumers. As I mentioned, this makes up a relatively small slice of what you and I pay for power. But machines like wind farms and solar installations have access to free fuel, so once they're built, they can offer energy at $0. This low offer means they get dispatched by the operator for being so cheap, and cheaper generators being dispatched means the final price ends up being lower. This is called the merit order effect. It's minor, but then so are the certificate costs, so it all balances out. In February 2014, Tony Abbott initiated his review of the Renewable Energy Target Scheme based on his concerns about electricity price impacts. He handpicked a panel for the review, headed by self-described climate skeptic and ex-fossil fuel businessman Dick Warburton. What the modelling firm commissioned by the panel found is that if you scrap the scheme, close it to new entrants, or reduce the renewable energy target, then retail electricity bills are forecast to be higher in the long term than if you just left the scheme alone. The only scenario they modelled that saw a reduction in electricity bills was an expansion of the RET scheme. This is because in the long term, the merit order effect reduces price more than the certificate costs increase it. Renewable energy schemes aren't causing significant price pressure, as claimed so often by opponents of the technology. But reality offers nothing as tantalising as the story of clean technology wreaking havoc on average Australian citizens. Prime Minister Abbott repeated his claim on Tuesday, the 10th of February this year, declaring that his intention to cut the renewable energy target was based on efforts to lower electricity bills. It hasn't been 6 months since his own review found that cutting it would raise electricity bills for Australian consumers. The narrative won't be let go. We've seen narratives drive high-level political machinations, but they also have sway down to the reactions of individuals living near proposed and operational wind farms. A phenomenon known as wind turbine syndrome is something I've been looking into since my early days in the wind industry. The disease was first hypothesised in 2009 by a paediatrician in New York. She published a book that featured phone interviews with a small number of families selected due to their status as complainants. Soon after the research was self-published by the paediatrician, it was picked up by a credulous media outlet, and the myth spread to Australia. The concept serves the purpose of filling one of the most terrifying and unnerving gaps that any of us will encounter in our lives. There's likely no one who hasn't experienced, either through themselves or someone they love, the sheer terror of physiological tribulation, such as pain, nausea, headaches, sleeplessness, in the absence of any decent scientific explanation of their origin. Those who are sick are understandably looking to fill that gap, and they don't always get the answers they need or want from registered medical health professionals. A very large number of health bodies across the world have assessed the evidence underpinning the claims put forward by anti-wind groups that focus on health impacts and low-frequency noise emissions. None of them have found any evidence to suggest inaudible low-frequency noise from wind turbines can cause any of the symptoms attributed to wind farms. In recent months, the Canadian governmental department tasked with protecting the health of citizens announced the result of a one-year, $2.1 million study into wind turbine syndrome. It involved 1,238 homes, 4,000 hours of acoustic data, 17 different models of wind turbine, two provinces, and an expert committee comprised of government, academic, industry experts, and international advisors. After taking measurements from residents living near wind farms, they found no link between the operation of wind turbines and dizziness, migraines, heart disease, blood pressure, diabetes, heart rate, cortisol levels, or measured quality of sleep. They did find that as noise levels increased, people were more annoyed by the noise, the shadow of the blades, or the aircraft warning lights on top of the machines. Those receiving financial benefit from the turbines were statistically significantly less annoyed than those who were not. One response that was published a few hours after the release of the report caught my eye. It's from a group called Wind Concerns Ontario, one of Canada's foremost anti-wind groups. The president of the group said, quote, "We have deep concerns about the methodology and conclusions, and that, finally, these results do not reconcile with the experience of Ontario communities." This is a near-perfect example of what happens when the stories we've used to fill the gaps in our knowledge collide with scientific investigation. The science doesn't match the experience. This creates a conundrum for policymakers. When the science contradicts stories passionately defended by humans, which side do you take? The National Health and Medical Research Council recently announced a call for more research into wind turbine syndrome. The idea that research outcomes would be accepted by vociferous wind farm opponents is dangerously naive. There are good scientific explanations of why we fill gaps in our knowledge about climate, renewables, and health. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman explains that we tend to think in two ways, fast and slow. Fast is instinctive and emotional. Slow is deliberative and reasoned. He talks about the cognitive machinery needed for fast and slow thinking as being divided into two systems. In a lecture, Kahneman proposes that there is coherence. System 1 produces coherent stories, even on the basis of very little evidence. It is a machine for jumping to conclusions. So when you have minimal amount of evidence, if it fits into a story, you generate that story. What Kahneman describes as a machine for jumping to conclusions is the bit of our brain that fills the causal gap. This is why wind farm opponents in Ontario rejected the outcomes of the study within hours of its release. The gap-filling story takes precedence over the science. Kahneman's System 1 is a powerful machine, and the alternative, using slow thinking to let the evidence simmer in your brain, requires more effort, and it takes longer. Additionally, research conducted by Dunning and Kruger shows that the worse people perform at a task, the more they overestimate their own performance. Conversely, people who perform better at a task know the limits of their knowledge and slightly underestimate their own performance. This is known as the Dunning-Kruger effect. Their work sheds more light on why we place so much weight on stories that directly contradict science, particularly on issues that require expertise to fully understand. Sometimes we also defend narrative knowledge gap fillers because we're driven by the way we define ourselves. I've seen a variety of criticisms of renewable energy and climate science that seem to emerge from claims about identity. Climate science is a conspiracy because it's an affront to my belief in the free market. The renewable energy target must be expensive because I know clean technology will never work. Wind turbine syndrome must be real because big corporations are prone to causing harm to me and my fellow citizens. There's research behind this as well. The Cultural Cognition Project at Yale University examines how ideology and identity affect our thinking. Quote, like fans who see the disputed calls of a referee as correct, depending on whether they favour their team or its opponent, the subjects in our study perceived scientists as credible experts, depending on whether the scientists' conclusions supported the position favoured by members of the subject's cultural group, or the one favoured by the members of a rival one, on climate change, nuclear power, and gun control, unquote. Gaps between the public and scientific understanding of climate science, or gaps between community and scientific understanding of health issues, exist not due to ignorance or stupidity, but due partly to identity. I've seen the unrealities that fill these gaps defended with an incredible burning passion. When you present scientific, engineering, or economic evidence that contradicts stories that people hold dear, you're presented with a strong reaction because an individual perceives that you're not challenging an idea, but that you're challenging them. I didn't know it when I was a teenager lying in bed, listening to the eerie noises emanating from a herd of radio telescopes late at night. But the CSIRO in Marsfield is responsible for amazing scientific discoveries. They were instrumental in securing scientific evidence that led to the creation of Wi-Fi, and astronomers at the facility made the hidden glow of a galaxy 14 million light-years away visible. I still don't know what the noises were, but it's extremely likely that all I was listening to were bits of science doing scientific things, perhaps the mechanical components of radio telescopes shifting their position. In this case, the reality is thrilling, even more thrilling than the science fiction stories of spacecraft I'd fill the gaps in my knowledge with. Recognizing when we're motivatedly filling in gaps is extremely important. It also means that simply providing more information to people who don't seem to have enough isn't going to change their mind. If we're threatening their very sense of self, then we might actually make things worse.
And so talk as a human being with values rather than as a mere expert. The heated discussion goes on. Ketan Joshi, now working in renewable energy. Next week, Dr. Robert Solomon, former federal MP, on driving and being monitored by Big Brother. I'm Robin Williams.